Yeah, that's a really powerful question.
That's a beautiful question.
That's a great question, Lauren.
Hello, and welcome to The Right Question, a radio program and podcast featuring authors from the American West and beyond. The Right Question is supported in part by Humanities Montana and members of Montana Public Radio, and by the Greater Montana Foundation, encouraging communication on issues, trends, and values of importance to Montanans. I'm Lauren Korn, speaking with novelist Emily St. John Mandel, author of Station 11, a National Book Award finalist and one of the New York Times 100 Best Books of the 21st Century. Set in the eerie days following civilization's collapse after a flu pandemic, Station 11 charts the strange twists of fate that connect five people. A famous Hollywood actor who dies on stage during a production of King Lear, the man who tried to save him, the actor's first wife, his oldest friend, and a young actress with the Traveling Symphony, a nomadic group of actors roaming the scattered outposts of the Great Lakes region and caught in the crosshairs of a dangerous self-proclaimed prophet. First published in 2014, Station 11 has awed its readers for 10 years, and I sat down to talk with Emily about the relationship she had to the book that catapulted her to fame, the book that some say predicted our very real COVID pandemic. Emily, thank you so much for joining me. Welcome to The Right Question.
Thank you so much. It's a pleasure to be here.
We're here to talk about Station 11. You're traveling to Montana to give the President's Lecture Series on this book. And this book is 10 years old.
Yeah.
Congratulations. Happy 10 years to Station 11 and to you. Yeah. It seems like such an accomplishment to write a book with such staying power. And I know it's a book that I still think about even 10 years after I read it as a bookseller in 2014. I'm curious, after all we know now, I wouldn't say we're post-pandemic, but through sort of a pandemic, would you write Station 11 now? Or maybe the alternative question, how would you rewrite Station 11 now? Are there details that you might change in light of how our own pandemic has played out, or now that your readers of this book have experienced a pandemic themselves?
Yeah, there are a couple of things I would change. One of them has to do with the difference between the imagined experience of a pandemic and the actual experience of a pandemic. And the other has to do with the way that our country has changed. So I'll do the first one first. I think that even with all my research into pandemics and the history and mechanisms of pandemics, I think I'd thought of being in a pandemic as something of a binary state, as in you're either in a pandemic or you're not in a pandemic, like the pandemic light switch is like off or on. But there's such a strange disorienting in-between state in the very early days and in kind of the end game. I would argue that that's where we are now. You know, as you said, we're not entirely out. People die of COVID every year. But we are obviously past the kind of immediate crisis point of it. And so it's this weird territory we live in where it's almost impossible to make rational choices around risk assessment. And, you know, for myself, I'm totally inconsistent. Like sometimes I wear a mask on planes and sometimes I don't, based on, I don't know what, like vibes, you know, it's like it doesn't make any sense. If somebody's coughing near me, I'll put on a mask. I've never been afraid of dying of COVID, you know, since we got past. Obviously, we were all afraid of that in March of 2020. But, you know, after we learned a little bit more about the virus, it's not personally a concern for me. So, yeah, you know, it's just hard to make decisions around risk assessment. That's true now. And it was true in January, February 2020, when we kind of knew it was coming, but kind of didn't believe it because it seemed so unimaginable. It hadn't happened to us in 100 years. So, yeah, that's something I would have done differently in Station 11. You know, the pandemic doesn't just hit. It's already all around you before you realize what it is. The other thing having to do with the way the country's changed, this is actually kind of disturbing and like opens a whole can of worms around consensual reality and our shared experience of the world. there's a scene in Station 11 when all of these airplanes are diverted to the nearest airports as this crisis unfolds. And in Station 11, people get off a plane at a small fictional airport in Michigan, and they all gather below a TV monitor tuned to, I want to say CNN, I don't remember, but something like that. And they all believe everything the newscaster is saying. And I swear to God, that was plausible in 2011 when I wrote that. Disinformation works. You know, I think we've been the subject of several very successful disinformation campaigns. And that's given us kind of a fractured media landscape at this point, where, you know, if I try to map that scene onto the present day, it doesn't really work. Like, some people would believe CNN. Other people would be ranting about a liberal conspiracy. Other people would be ranting about a mega conspiracy. You know, we're just a very, very fractured people who've kind of lost a shared understanding of reality. So, yeah, if I were trying to write Station 11 in the present day, there would be much more of that, that distrust, I suppose.
Because you wrote Station 11 before COVID, did you feel at all, not better equipped, but at all equipped psychologically or emotionally or even intellectually, because you had done research, to navigate the tumult that we all kind of felt came out of nowhere, even though had we been paying attention, it did not come out of nowhere. Does that ring true at all?
That's super embarrassing. I'd literally been touring a lecture that contained the phrase, there will always be another pandemic. But I feel like I was as blindsided as everybody else. I think, I think all of us compartmentalize to some extent in our day-to-day lives. And I just didn't ever really connect that lecture to my life outside of my professional life, like my life outside of the lectures. I feel like I was as blindsided as anybody else. Because it's one thing to know intellectually that there will always be another pandemic. Now, that is just part of the human experience. But it's something else to try to navigate it when it actually arrives.
I want to go back to what you said about risk assessment and sort of tie it into talking about the traveling symphony and the idea that there are many Shakespeare in the Park troupes that perform around the world too. And these performers, not only in the traveling symphony of Station 11, but these Shakespeare in the Park troupes, they have adjusted to the changing circumstances of their environments, whether it's incorporating weather events into their performances, if it rains during a show. Mm-hmm. There's also a conflation of time, even because of that foresight, because of their sort of normalization of crisis or their anticipation of crisis, the future inhabits and becomes so intrinsic to the present. But it's also the future, so it hasn't happened. It hasn't yet arrived. And I want to tie that to a character in your most recent novel, Sea of Tranquility, who asks, what if it is always the end of the world? And so this is a really long preface, Emily, to ask how you conceive of time now, particularly as it relates to crisis or, in your words, risk assessment or adaptation.
Good question. I think less in terms of time or my sense of time having changed, but I think more than I used to about the idea of the end of the world, which sounds really dark, but it isn't at all. I spent a lot of time delivering a lecture about Station 11. Like, I traveled with that lecture for, I think, about 5 years after the book came out. I actually didn't stop until March 2020 when everything stopped. And so that gave me a lot of time to kind of think about and refine this idea that what if the world is always ending? And that sounds scary, but it's not actually a negative. To kind of illustrate it by example, a number of years ago, my mom came to visit me in New York City, and we went to this really cool exhibition at the Morgan Library. It was an exhibition of illuminated manuscripts, most of them hundreds of years old. And there was this one in particular that I remember. It was this beautiful little square book, just like incredibly ornate with this kind of like gold embroidered cover. It was an English translation of a French poem that had been transcribed by an 11-year-old Elizabeth I as a New Year's gift for her stepmother. And my mom made kind of an interesting observation. She said, you know, that wasn't that long ago. Like in the grand scale of human history, that little book's about 500 years old. That's what, like six lifetimes laid end to end. But the world in which that book was written is long since gone. It's completely lost to us. You can't point to any grand cataclysm that ended it, but it's gone nonetheless. You know, that world has ended. But then you even take that back to a more micro scale. I am just barely old enough to remember, you know, the world before the internet. And that world's also ended. You know, I remember the first cell phones, and I remember that there was more peace and privacy before them, as much as I'm addicted to my iPhone, like everybody else. So it's interesting to think of the way the world keeps changing, of the way one world after another kind of comes to an end, and a new world sort of rotates into place around it. I think, though, like returning to your question about time, I think what changes in moments of crises is that it happens faster, where it's like in the usual rhythm of things. And it's hard to say that because there is always a crisis, you know, someplace or another. But in, you know, quote unquote, normal life, an old world is slowly moving away from us. A new world is always slowly rotating into place. You don't notice those transitions usually, unless there is some kind of crisis, a pandemic or a war or something of that nature. The British Indian novelist Arundhati Roy had this amazing essay along these lines toward the beginning of the pandemic. She said, a pandemic is a portal. And that stayed with me, you know, partly because it's kind of amazing and poetic and interesting. But just that idea that maybe a pandemic, or more broadly speaking, a moment of crisis, is like this fast passage from one world into another. It's like you've stepped through a portal into something totally unrecognizable. And it's incredibly disorienting. You know, if you think about what our lives were like in, oh, let's say April 2020, where it's like that profound disorientation of, oh my God, how did we end up in this world? The old world was 3 months ago. So yeah, that was a very digressive answer to an interesting question, but that's something I've been thinking about lately.
I guess I want to stay with this idea of time for just another minute, sure. Especially because you're talking about, or you spoke to this idea of memory, your idea of memory before technologies like cell phones or, you know, Wi-Fi. In Station 11, you're jumping between a before and after, these characters' lives before the Georgia flu hits, before this pandemic, and then the 20 years after. And this movement in time is something of a literary device, but you've also written your characters as actively remembering and trying to remember their pasts. Time travel is also a theme across your novels. So I think this question, Emily, is a craft question. I'm wondering how you use memory, whether it's your character's memory or your own memory, to inform the shape of the futures that you're writing into.
If we want to get into craft, I could talk about moving through time.
Let's
if that's
do it.
Interesting.
Let's do it.
Okay.
Yeah.
So with Station 11, I wanted to write about this post-technological world. But then I wanted the technology to feel kind of immediate, even though none of these characters, well, I shouldn't say that. A lot of these characters don't really remember the technology, or they remember it in kind of like the abstract way of our early childhood memories. You know, Kirsten has this thing. She was 8 when the world ends. She has this thing of like trying to remember fridges and questioning her memories. Like, was there really light inside? Not just cold, but also light. And it's like thinking about those technologies in kind of a sci-fi way was kind of an interesting part of this project for me. But then also, like, kind of from a craft perspective, I'm always kind of going for efficiency and kind of, I guess, vibrancy, for lack of a better word. So I had this idea thinking, you know, in the post-apocalyptic sections, I could have a character thinking about, you know, remember when there were airplanes in the world and have them like reminiscing about that. And I do get into that a little bit, but you can also just skip back in time and put you in an airplane, you know, as a reader. So I liked the idea of kind of using the past to illustrate what was lost in the present. And if I'm kind of thinking aloud here, I guess memory does play into that. You know, just, I did spend a lot of time thinking about what these characters would remember of this vanished world and kind of their relationship with those memories. Like, are those things that they long for and try to recreate, or are they things that they kind of want to leave behind? Where, like, most characters would go back if they could, you know, which I think most of us would in that situation. We would want to go back to the time when you could easily get insulin, for example, or antibiotics. But then for Jeevan, he was kind of aimless, you know, in our present day. And he found a real sense of meaning in his life in this post-apocalyptic time. So I don't know that he would remember our world in particularly fond terms. You know, he would absolutely miss the people that he lost. But he was not happier in the before than the after.
You're listening to A Conversation with Emily St. John Mandel. I'm Lauren Korn. This episode of The Right Question is supported by Fact and Fiction, an independent bookstore located in the heart of downtown Missoula, Montana, providing books for all ages and supporting the literary community in Montana and beyond. More information can be found at factandfictionbooks.com. As someone, too, who was alive and a child before the advent of the internet, I wonder how quickly we would lose the memory of those technologies, right? Like, I wonder if just if we're in the world of Station 11, I don't know. I feel like the world that you've built in this book, and maybe it's a misreading, but I feel like the world that you've built in this book is one in which these characters have, they've adapted so well to this post-apocalyptic world that, and maybe this is just, maybe this is you just being like a wonderful writer and not making me miss those technologies, because I didn't. As a reader, I wasn't really missing those technologies. Of course, as you said, there are medical advancements that would be deeply and greatly missed. But I wonder how we would respond to not having the internet for a while. And maybe like there would be great advantage, especially in a world very dependent on our survival in like an environment where the internet is actually not anything we need, or these particular technologies are not anything we actually need.
Yeah, there's something to that. I actually have a whole theory about how one of the reasons why we're so drawn to post-apocalyptic stories is because of a certain, I guess, ambivalence around our technology, where I think I speak for a lot of people when I say I both love and hate the internet. You know, it's incredible to be able to look things up. You know, I mentioned the festival I just did in France. And like every other time I've been in France, I spend a lot of time like Googling verb conjugations. And like just having that kind of knowledge so immediately incredibly available, like that's amazing. On the other hand, like you go onto Twitter/X and it's just like, what would the loss be to humanity if this platform no longer existed? And we'd say negligible, you know, we could have a lot more space in our lives if we didn't partake of these things. These things are designed to be addictive. So I think there's sort of a loop we can get into where you feel bad about how much time you spent on Instagram today. Everything about Instagram was designed to keep you on Instagram. You know, these little hits of dopamine that you get as you, you know, as the algorithm does its work on you and you look at all the pictures. Yeah, so I think if we were to lose these technologies, they would very quickly begin to seem like science fiction. And you mentioned memory earlier. There's something about the way memory is corrupted by almost by talking about things. It's hard to express, but it's like I have this situation with Station 11 where the book was published 10 years ago, which means I was fully done writing it 11 years ago. Which means that honestly, my memory of parts of the book are a little bit hazy. But it's like I've been doing events for this book for the past decade, which, by the way, is an incredible situation to be in. And I am so grateful. Like it's amazing that this book has found the readership that it has. There are questions that come up fairly regularly, and I know the answers to them. You know, what was I thinking when I wrote X in chapter Y? Like that kind of thing. Or what was my starting point for Station 11? And it's like, I know the answers to these questions because I've answered them so often. But then as time passes, a certain doubt creeps in where it's like, is that really what I was thinking when I wrote the book? Or do I just know the answer to this question because it's a question I've been answering? And those are sort of two different things in a weird way. Yeah, I don't know where I'm going here, except to say the way that retrieving a memory corrupts the memory, I think, is a really big part of the question. And it's really interesting to me, you know, in our post-apocalyptic future, if you're Kirsten and you're trying to remember how a fridge worked, you know, was there light as well as cold? How do you remember that there was cold? Or you just know that there was cold because you've been told that that was how a refrigerator operated? It's just, yeah, it's interesting to think about the way talking about these memories changes them.
Absolutely. I want to linger on this idea of this book being 10 years old and you lecturing and touring mm-hmm. this book for a decade, which if our listeners don't already know, that's rare for a single book. Like the turnover, I guess, of the book marketplace is very, very fast. But you've been talking about this book for 10 years. I'm curious. And you may have already answered this question, I guess, but I'm curious if you're able to see the characters and even the narrative of this novel anew after so much time. Like, are you experiencing your book anew each time someone asks you a question? These new readers are encountering your work.
Yeah, yeah. No, it's interesting because I think that I do see the book anew because a novel's kind of a time capsule. Like the novel that I wrote in 2011 is not the novel I'd write today because, you know, I'm just a different person than I was in 2011. You know, life changes you. So I do see the book anew, but I think it has very little to do with the book and more just the way that as I move further and further away from the person I was when I wrote that book, it's like I'm a more and more different person, but the book stays where it was. So I do see it anew, just as kind of a function of having changed as a person. But, you know, to go back to what you were just saying about how unusual that is to be talking about a book for that long, there were a couple of kind of weird extenuating circumstances where, yeah, like normally you don't talk about a book for a decade. That's not a thing. but in this case, so I had the promotional tour, which went for, I don't know, like a year and a half or 2 years between the hardcover and the paperback. And then I had this really lucky thing happen where Station 11 was chosen as one of the National Endowment for the Arts Big Reads book, which is an expedited grant process. If a town or a library system wants to do like a one town, one book program, then there's some kind of special process to get funding for books on the list. So Station 11 was on that. And so I traveled for years. It was kind of amazing, you know, just these lectures about Station 11. And then as that was winding down, the pandemic hit. But then I went out on a book tour for the next book. So yeah, I was promoting The Glass Hotel in the spring of 2020, which is a very different book. It's about white collar crime and it's a ghost story. And it's like, we would start talking about The Glass Hotel, but The Glass Hotel was published on March 25th, 2020. So like, oh my God, we were distracted. The conversation would pivot within like 5 minutes back to Station 11, which was fine. You know, the pandemic was what everybody, including me, wanted to talk about. And that circumstance was so strange that it was part of the starting point for the subsequent book I wrote, Sea of Tranquility. So, you know, Sea of Tranquility has this section about an author on tour for a pandemic book as a pandemic's breaking out. So then that like catapults me right back to Station 11. So yeah, it's funny how I keep on being pulled back to that book.
I'm curious, Emily, what of our time or our reality, our earth now, are you proactively grieving? What do you already miss from a world that is, you know, as we know it, crumbling? What jumpstarts your homesickness?
It's a great question. It's hard to separate things I miss that relate to the way the world's changing and things I miss that relate to having switched countries where, you know, I was born and raised in Canada and I came to the States and I was 22, and I don't regret it. I've had incredible opportunities here and an incredible life, and I'm grateful for all of it. I really miss gun control and you know, just accessible healthcare. Like those were things I took for granted when I was young, and those are things I miss a lot. It's a more peaceful life if you have those things. I miss, not to get too political, but I miss the certainty that I used to have before the January 6th riots, that there would always be a peaceful transfer of power. Like, that was nice. That was something I took for granted. Yeah, I think those are maybe the major things for me.
Yeah, and those are things that sounds like you already miss. Those are things
I
that
do.
Are missed. You've been asked this question, and I'm going to try to spin it a little bit. You've been asked the question, can art give life meaning amidst catastrophe? I think I want my question to you to be, do you believe that art, whether it's performing Shakespeare or writing novels, do you believe that art incites action? Do you consider art making a healing resource or a galvanizing force in any way?
I don't think that I've very often seen it incite action. I have seen it give people a kind of hope. So maybe that hope incites action, you know, in kind of an indirect way.
What gives you hope right now? What gives you optimism?
But there is still hope. You know, there's a lot of energy. Like, there are people out there who are very energetically trying to make this a better country and a better world. And that's kind of amazing to see. So that we do still care about, you know, we still care about books and the arts more broadly, and things that are just kind of beyond the basics of survival. So yeah, I guess that gives me a lot of hope and optimism too. You know, sometimes times are good and sometimes times are bad, and nothing lasts forever. And there's like, there's a weird kind of optimism in that idea, that wherever you are on the political spectrum, I think you'd agree that it's a stressful moment. You know, perhaps it won't always be. Like, there's hope in the idea that perhaps someday the country will be a little less fraught and a little more chill. You know, fingers crossed.
A little more chill. I don't know. Well, Emily, thank you so much for spending this time with me. And I can't wait to meet you in person when you come to Montana. Thank you.
Yeah, looking forward to it. Thank you so much.
That was Emily St. John Mandel, author of Station 11, out now from Vintage Books, an imprint of Penguin Random House. She's also the author of five other novels, most recently Sea of Tranquility, which has been translated into 25 languages and was selected by President Barack Obama as one of his favorite books of 2022. Emily lives in New York City and Los Angeles. To learn more about Emily and to listen to this conversation again or to share it with friends, go to mtpr.org. You've been listening to The Right Question. This episode was produced by Chris Moyles and me. I'm your host, Lauren Korn. Chris also engineered this episode. The artwork for The Right Question was designed by Molly Russell. Funding for The Right Question is provided by the Greater Montana Foundation, encouraging communication on issues, trends, and values of importance to Montanans. Many thanks to Humanities Montana for supporting this program since 2008, and thank you for listening. The Right Question is a production of Montana Public Radio.